Welcome to A Lawyer's Guide to the Galaxy, a podcast about geek culture by lawyers with your hosts, Ben Siders and Kirk Damon.
And welcome back to episode 2 of Lawyer's Guide to the Galaxy in Camera, the podcast that does not yet have a tagline or slogan because we keep spontaneously deciding to record things and not actually sitting down and planning anything. I am one of your hosts, Ben Siders. The other guy is Kirk Damon.
It's still Kirk as in the Captain of the Enterprise.
And we are here to talk about Star Wars Visions, Season 2, I should say.
Yep.
If you don't know what that is, well, first of all, we'll link in the show notes to our review of Vision Season 1 from a couple years ago.
Which is in the main Lawyer's Guide to the Galaxy.
It's in the main catalog. But we're going to talk about Season 2, which finished up a month or two ago. And this is the what'd you call it? Like an anthology of short anime shorts, basically set in the Star Wars universe. Season one was very heavily focused on Japanese content creators. Although I just read today we're not supposed to call it content anymore. I guess that's offensive to creative types.
So, okay, that's a new one.
So, okay, but anyway, so we apologize. But yeah, for let's say creators and season two is kind of gone outside of that. And gosh, Kirk, we've got people from everywhere doing it.
Yeah, I know there's at least one Korean one or two Korean studios.
Yeah, there was a
French studio, I think.
A South Asian, Middle Eastern, a South American, all over the map.
I want to say Indian.
Yeah, I think we said when they first announced this that, boy, that's interesting. I definitely want to see what Argentine anime looks like. And now we know.
Yeah.
So we're going to try and do maybe 5 minutes on each episode, give our general thoughts on it. We both watched this a while ago, so we may have to kind of refresh our memory as we go here on what these were. And then we'll try to, if we can figure out a way, come up with some kind of coherent ordinal ranking for these like we did last time.
Exactly.
So, all right, so let's get started. Episode 1 in Season 2 is titled Sith, directed by Rodrigo Blas, B-L-A-A-S, animated by El Guiri, G-U-I-R-I. We're going to butcher these pronunciations.
We'll
just apologize in advance. Here's your short description. These are from the Wikipedia page. As the Sith remain in hiding during the reign of the High Republic, Lola, a former Sith apprentice, lives in solitude on a desolate planet with her droid E2 and is trying to channel the Force into painting her base. Despite her efforts, the paint keeps forming dark smudges that won't go away. While investigating a droid that crashed on the planet, she is suddenly visited by her former Sith master, who chases her down to her base on two droids and forces her to fight him. Inside, he insists that she is to become the new Sith master by killing him and forcing the rule of two. Lola comes to the realization that she needs to accept both light and dark halves, and promptly kills the Sith master when her double-edged lightsaber produces one yellow and one red blade. So that's basically it. This one, what a way to kick it off.
Yeah, I mean, this was a great episode. It really was.
It was thematically good. The art style was so bizarre. Like, it looked like an animated painting. Yeah. I don't know how else to describe it.
The coolest thing I think about this entire one, this is one of, I think, few things I've seen that used its own anime style and its own, the fact that it was animated, I really should say, in conjunction with it, as part of its plot.
Yeah, it was like a narrative element, because like, if you haven't seen it, we should say we're going to spoil these, so if you haven't seen them, go see them. But if you haven't seen it, the way that it's painted, it's almost like a cell painting, but it's like she's walking through an incomplete painting.
Yeah, so she's painting it as she moves.
Yeah, she'll walk through like blank white spaces. And at first, I had no idea what was going on, and it confused the hell out of me. But once I figured out what they were doing, it made a little more sense. And as the story unfolds, more and more of it gets filled in. It's really a neat effect.
It's a really neat effect. It's an incredibly cool thing to watch. It's an incredibly cool thing to watch a second time. That's one of the things I noticed with it about it. The other thing I think which was neat about this one is it explored the idea, and we're going to comment about this. We've said this comment about it. It's interesting how many of the main characters in this effectively are Sith, or at least bending that direction, and how many of our Jedi-based characters are women in conjunction
almost
with this.
All of almost them all we're going to keep track of it as we go.
But it's one of those where this one is one where I really liked the way they investigated her. Of the idea of what does it mean to walk away from being a Sith apprentice? And is that even possible?
Yeah.
And that's kind of what this gets into is it not possible? You are who you are as she's trying to write her own story. The coolest thing I think by far of this is they mentioned in conjunction with it is the double-sided lightsaber with two different colored blades.
We don't think we've ever seen that before.
We've never seen anything like that before. The only person I know of who ever used two different colored blades, I believe, was Ahsoka. in one of the Clone Wars episodes. I want to say at one point in time she uses a green and a blue blade because she always fights with two.
Anakin does in episode 3 only because he gets a hold of somebody else's lightsaber.
Maybe
it's episode 2.
But I thought Ahsoka, she starts off with two green ones, and I thought at one point in time she switches to a green and a blue. And I may be wrong about that because it's just there's so much that happens in that was so long ago, and it's such a long series that it was one of those where I'm like, I can't remember if that's 100% true. But it's one of those where what I did really like about it is the concept of the other side of the blade, the side of you are what you are, and in this case she's both, being just kind of a cool effect.
Yeah.
So I like that a lot. But the one that I can't talk about this is the art style. Loved the style, the way this was animated. It was just such a cool concept.
You'll either love it or hate it. I've talked to other Star Wars fans, and I've heard a lot of people really hated this episode because of the art style. So either it's going to make or break it for you, I think. If you like the art style, then you'll enjoy the way that it's thematically woven into the narrative. And it's I very much enjoyed it. So like that one a lot. Okay, moving on. Episode 2, titled Screecher. Oh, we should go back to the cast. Lola is voiced by Ursula Corberó, and the Sith Master is Luis Tosar. Never heard of either of them, but they do have Wikipedia pages, so they've done things. Okay, episode 2 is titled Screecher's Reach, directed by Paul Young, written by Will Collins and Jason Tamamaji, animated by a studio called Cartoon Saloon. And here's your description. Prior to the initial extinction of the Sith, a young girl named Dahl, that's D-A-A-L, lives in a workhouse with her friends. Tired of living there, Dahl convinces her friends to head out to Screecher's Reach, a remote cave, with her by stealing some land speeders. The cave is rumored to hold a ghost within its walls, and the friends are eager to find it. Throughout the journey, Dahl is motivated by an unusual necklace she carries. They find the cave and find the ghost, who turns out to be an elderly Sith apprentice woman that has been trapped inside. Dahl's friends run away, and then using the Force, Dahl crushes the ghost with a boulder and then finishes her off with her own lightsaber. After Dahl escapes the cave, the necklace is revealed to be a communicator to a Sith Lord called the Sith Mother, who had given Dahl the task to finish off her own apprentice and take her place at the Mother's side in exchange for refuge from the sweatshop. Despite Dahl's efforts, the Sith Mother refuses to also take her friends, leaving them feeling betrayed. As Dahl reluctantly leaves, she looks back at her friends one last time. This is a theme we're going to see over here.
One thing I think is interesting about this is the provided description as to what it is clearly states that the Jedi we meet at the end is a Sith.
That was ambiguous.
Which is ambiguous, I believe, when you watch it.
Yeah.
I assume that that's because that was what was intended, was to be the Sith. So they know that
she's called the Sith Mother, so it must have been maybe in the cast list or in the credits or something to clarify that.
But I think it's important to note it is ambiguous when you watch it.
She didn't come across as very Sithy to me.
Yeah. But she also didn't come across as very Jedi.
No, definitely not.
And what the reason I mentioned I think it's important to be ambiguous. Is because I think a lot of this presentation, and this one in particular, has a lot of questions of what is good, what is bad, ambiguity. There's an issue in conjunction with the elderly Sith that is the Screecher in Screecher's Reach. That she kills her, yes, but it's almost, is it an act of mercy or is it an act of essentially murder? I mean, they kind of play off of the ambiguity. Yeah. Her asking to take the friends... Well, taking the friends if she's a Sith Lord is a bad thing. Isn't that actually, and so I think there's one of the big things that plays around with this is ambiguity. And to me, that was one of the things with it. One thing I would note about this one, and one of the things I thought about it, this is one of the few Star Wars episodes, I think, in anything that is truly scary.
It was scary. I'm not easily frightened by this kind of stuff, particularly not in animation. But the art style and the direction and the way that the Screecher is introduced was genuinely unnerving. I had a couple of jump scares never work on me, but this one did.
Yeah. And even outside the jump scare, she's disturbing.
Yeah. She comes across as just crazy, like crazy and screaming, and the sound design is really good. So this one was extremely just atmospheric is how I describe it. Very effectively done.
Yeah, and I think that's the best thing for it. Again, I think that it really focused on the concept of ambiguity. It was an interesting animation style. And again, the animation style plays heavily into the Screecher's Reach, what you see. It's got a little bit more of a kind of slash, informal type style, I'd say. It doesn't look polished, but that's good. It really works with it and stuff like that. And yeah, to me, this was just... Plot-wise, I found this to be one of the most intriguing plots.
Yeah, it was very simple, too. Very simple. Yeah, very well done. The cast, by the way, is Eva Whitaker, Alex Connolly, Noah Rafferty, Molly McCann, Angelica Houston, and Nia Moyles. Just based on the names, I'm guessing this is an Irish studio, maybe? Hard to say. But very, very sort of Western Anglican type names. Yeah, another good episode. I thought both these first two started out with a bang. And both of them, the art styles were very strongly complementary to the narrative themes and just the way it was put together. So really both good ones. Okay, number three is titled In the Stars. The director is Gabriel Osorio, also written by Osorio, animated by the studios called Punk Robot. During the Reign of the Empire, two sisters, Koten and Tichina, I'm probably pronouncing those wrong, I forget how they pronounced them in the show, are the last of their kind after the Empire conquered their planet and committed genocide on their species. Their mother, a Force-sensitive, led a failed rebellion against the Empire, who have created a factory that took their clean water. She was killed in the resulting conflict, and the factory has since caused severe light pollution as well as water pollution for the sea. While Tichina is convinced that they can defeat them with the Force, the elder and jaded Koten is solely focused on keeping them both alive. After they run out of water, Koten is forced to sneak into the factory to take water from the factory's water purifiers. However, Tichina follows her inside and gets spotted by stormtroopers. Exposed, they attempt to flee, but Tichina runs back inside, intending to destroy the primary water tank with the Force, and with it, the base. Subsequently caught, she's nearly executed, but Koten awakens her own Force abilities to save her sister, and together they destroy the factory and flood everyone within. As the sisters happily embrace, they see that life is returning to the planet, and their mother, who they believe is a star, looks down upon them. Cast, Koten is Valentina Moore, Tichina is Julia Oviedo, and then we have a couple of officers, Katie Dickey, and Amparo Noguera, depending on whether you have the English or Spanish translation. So I'm guessing this is a Spanish language
studio. This one I thought was interesting, and I have to say, in this one, I did not like this one the first time I saw it particularly. I liked it substantially better the second time I saw it. I saw most of these twice because it's both my kids wanted to see him, and I could never get a chance to watch it with both of them. So I saw it with each one of them individually.
We should say this one has sort of what I call it, almost a claymation animation style. It's not claymation, but it's kind of got the characters have that fabric look, like fabric dolls that are being like posed and moved. This is a purely a me thing. I absolutely hate that animation style. I find it so distracting and I'm constantly taken out of the narrative. I cannot suspend disbelief. I hate it. Despite that, I got pulled into the story. So the fact that I kind of enjoyed the story despite being so turned off by the animation style, I thought spoke to the strength of the writing.
Yeah, I like this one. My one major complaint I found about this one is, quite frankly, I found it a bit preachy. And I mean that in the fact that it was a little too blunt in what the Empire was doing that was bad.
Yeah.
And it wasn't one target. It was lots of targets. And to me, it was the kind of thing where it was just they made the Empire almost too overwhelmingly evil to be fought against by two sisters whose otherwise race has been destroyed. You know, it was too unlikely hero. The way I kind of put it in some respects is it's the problem with Anakin in episode one. He's too unlikely of a hero. That was the one complaint I had with this, is this was they were just too unlikely of a hero to have happen everything that happened in conjunction with this. It would have been nicer if it would have been a slightly smaller story.
Yeah, there's definitely no subtlety in the storytelling. The Empire is bad because they committed genocide. Okay, we get it.
They committed genocide, and they've completely polluted the environment, polluted and the air, and they're trying to kill you. And
I really wish they had done with this, you could have dropped the genocide and water pollution. Because the part of this that's thematically strong is sort of the religious belief that the people on this planet have in their ancestors becoming stars in the heavens. Yeah. Which is kind of weird for Star Wars. But you could do kind of a more tightly focused story on that aspect, and then just focus on the light pollution, which is a little less on the nose and a little more thematically strong with sort of the overall narrative elements. If they just kind of maybe tighten the lens a little bit on that, this would have really, really shined.
And then all they really had to do is break the factory. And again, even at the end, like one of the problems I had with it is they break the factory, which causes all the unpolluted water to spill into the polluted ocean, which somehow purifies it.
Yeah.
And it's like, no, wait, that doesn't work. Yeah. Like, we have a problem here.
We'll see that theme repeat, too, where sometimes the stories just get a little too big for something that's a short form format.
That's where I'm starting to hear. It's one of those where, I had the same issue with a couple of these. This one was sort of the first of them. Again, I thought the story here was just too big for the number of protagonists we had, with just the sisters. And I thought, with you, I thought that the concept of just rescuing the connection with the ancestors was an extremely interesting story in and of itself and could have been the entire focus.
Yeah, it kind of is introduced at one point where they go to, like, there's that monument, that rock, where they can kind of see the star through it. They're like, our mom is up there. That part was moving. But that, you know, other than the one sister, and then, you know, the sibling love is well done. But, like, the aspect of the mother being gone and being the star, it just kind of faints the background where we have a bunch of action sequences and a really heavy-handed, remind me of Avatar a little bit. Like, okay, we get it. The corporation's evil and it's run by some corporate jerk who just cares about his profits. You know, there's not a lot of subtlety, not a lot of deftness in the storytelling. That said, I still am very entertained by it.
Yeah, I was entertained by it. The one thing I did get a kick out of with this is I'd taken a trip to Turkey earlier in the year, and one of the things I happened to see were a bunch of ancient cave paintings, and they talked about painting around your hand using painting being an ancient cave painting technique, which they do in this. And I actually that just happened to strike me as something I thought was really cool that they did that. So anyway, yeah, I think we both kind of had, you know, very strong start. We're getting more into the depth as to what it is, but, you know, this one was not bad. It was just, I think, a little less interesting for us in some respects.
All right, number four is called I Am Your Mother, directed by Magdalena Osinka. Story also by Magdalena Osinka. Teleplay by Holly Walsh and Barunka O'Shaughnessy. Studio is called Aardman, A-A-R-D-M-A-N. Cast, Maxine Peake. Boy, there's a lot of people in this. I'm not going to get through it all. Charithra Chandram. Daisy Haggard, B.B. Cave, Dennis Lawson, Wedge Antilles. I just now realized that they actually got Dennis Lawson.
It is Wedge Antilles, yeah.
And then some people from Wallace and Gromit, which will make sense in a second. Some years after the defeat of the Empire, Wedge Antilles has formed a flight academy for new pilots. One of the cadets, a Twi'lek named Annie Kalfas, was inspired to become a pilot by her single mother, Kalina, but has since come to find her coddling embarrassing. Consequently, she neglects to tell her about a starship racing event from the Flight Academy where families compete against each other. And he's also picked on by fellow student Julian Van Riepel, whose mother, Dorota, pilots a much more sophisticated ship. When Kalina suddenly shows up to return Annie's lunch, she learns of the race and is egged on by the Van Riepels when they insult her ship. During the race, Annie admits to her mother that she embarrasses her, but she takes it in stride and has her win the race for them, defeating the Van Riepels. Annie apologizes for what she said, but Kalina tells her that embarrassing her is exactly what moms do best. A lot of truth in this one.
Yeah, exactly.
So, Kirk, I think I've Wallace and Gromit's great. I didn't watch a ton of it, but I know that it's that animation style.
It's that animation style,
which I really enjoy. This is kind of the opposite of the last one. I really enjoyed seeing that animation style done in Star Wars. Again, we have a female protagonist. We're four for four now. A female protagonist.
This one, we have no Jedi though.
Yeah, no Jedi, and really almost all of these are about the relationships between and among female characters.
Yep. This one being a daughter and her daughter and her mother.
We had sisters, mothers and daughters, masters and apprentices, friends, and then the first one was Solo. This one though, I don't know. What do you think? I know you and I talked about this. You had strong thoughts.
So my take to Daily in this, I like the fact they led into this being comedic. This was obviously a funny one.
Very silly.
It's very silly.
Which we kind of needed at this point.
And quite frankly, that was kind of cute. I think the problem with it is then they combined that with a heavy-handed moralistic tale.
So you and I saw this a little differently. I saw that as being a deliberate choice as opposed to like a lack of writing skill. More of a deliberate choice, like the Van Riepels. I mean, it sounds like the snotty rich family from a 1980s teenager movie.
Yeah.
I interpreted those as deliberate choices to kind of invoke that that genre, make it sort of a 16 Candles, Breakfast Club type.
Melodrama in some respects.
Yeah. So I think because I saw it that way, it didn't bother me so much. The whole thing felt like 15 minutes of somebody elbowing you to the ribs and saying, huh? Huh?
Yeah.
So I think that part, the fact that this one was so on the nose also and not even trying to hide it. I mean, the Van Riepels, their ship, it looks like a rich people.
Yeah, exactly.
Like, it looks very evil.
Well, and she behaves that way.
The mother's basically Cruella DeVille.
It's snotty and crazy. So, yeah.
Yeah, so I think maybe that's why you and I... that landed a little bit differently.
Well, and I think part of the thing to me with it is I appreciated the sort of, you know, the humor components of it, but to me it was the problem with it is that when they sort of leaned into that piece of it, it leaned into it not as it's a funny background and we're going to make this a sort of overbearing complete story, but it did seem like we're trying to point out the idea of the moms being embarrassing and stuff instead of leaning into it. And again, that's what I kind of bumped into, is I think they could have leaned into the humor of this and done exactly the same story without it having that kind of, what I said, a slight overbearing moralistic feel to it. while still told exactly the same story.
Did you catch it? I thought there were some references to other Wallace and Gromit animation. I could have sworn there was like a visual reference to the seagulls from Finding Nemo.
There's something with
Wasn't there somebody who says mine at one point?
I can't remember what it is. There's something where it's with Wedge. It's something around Wedge where he has it. The whole thing with him being a hologram and we're some bumping into his hologram, something like that. Yeah, I remember there was stuff we mentioned at
this
the time.
This one's very lighthearted and very silly. So it's you know, it's interesting the order they put these into, because if you watch them straight through, you get three straight, very dramatic, intense, serious, atmospheric ones. And then you get this one, which comes out of nowhere and is just goofiness.
Yeah, and quite frankly, it's one of the few things in Star Wars that's goofy at all.
Yeah.
You know, there's very little goofiness in Star Wars, especially not goofiness like this.
No.
Which is kind of real life goofiness. Like, you know, when she shows up with the ship, you know, her laundry falls off.
Yeah.
You know, like stuff. It's like, okay, you know, you really do get some of this kind of like real life goofiness. The one thing I do think it did really well, it does a great job of making you cringe with the behavior of the mother. And it's supposed to. That's the whole, I mean, she's a bit overdone. Because you need to point out that you need to be cringing at when her daughter sees her as well. You know, and they did do a good job of that. Again, I liked this one. I appreciated the humor. I thought the humor was great. I just would have liked to, frankly, see them lean into the humor a little more.
Okay. Number five, this one is, this is a Journey to the Dark Head. I think this was the Korean production.
Yep.
Directed by Hyung-gung Park, written by Chung Se-rang, and the studio is called Studio Mirror. The cast is enormous. I'm not going to list it off. Plus, they're all Korean names that I can't pronounce very well. During the initial war between the Jedi and Sith, an adolescent monk named Ara believes that the statues on her home planet, whose stones around its base have foretelling abilities, control both light and dark. That's a theme we're also going to see keep coming up. As one is lit in blue light and the other in red, she resolved to destroy the Dark Head in the belief that it can turn the tide of the war. Years later, Ara, now a teenage mechanic, requests the Jedi Council for a bodyguard on her quest. They assign a young Padawan named Towel to the task. Towel, that's T-O-U-L, not like, you know, kitchen towel, has recently lost his master at the hands of a sadistic Sith Lord, Bashan, leaving him traumatized and in constant fear. The two of them collect supplies and head to the planet where Bashan chases them. They make it to the statues, but Ara realizes that both light and dark evenly flow between them, making it impossible to destroy. Towel overcomes his fear and, with Ara's help, manages to kill Bashan. The two of them decide to continue journeying together. Kirk, go ahead.
I love this one.
Yeah.
I absolutely love this one. It's the thing that I had from it. There's so much going on behind this. There's so many
things. This is a good example of doing a big story and making it fit the format.
It's a huge story, but it's not really accurate. It's a huge theme and a tiny story.
Mm-hmm.
All this has to do with is destroying a single statue. That's what the entire thing is based on. But it's everything that gets drug into that, and what does it mean? Even the foretelling ability, and the question of her not necessarily exactly understanding what the foretelling ability means. The stone she foretells at the beginning ends up becoming important at the end. You know, there's elements of stuff like that. You have him as the Jedi assigned to her. You have definite Sith leanings as to what it is. This is, I think, our lone male Jedi.
Again, female protagonist.
Female protagonist, but lone male Jedi. But he's really portrayed as a character in conflict.
Mm-hmm, definitely.
And part of the sending behind this, you get the impression, is the Jedi Council of the, we're not sure you're stable.
Yeah.
And we kind of need to find out the answer to that question, which is also a theme we've never had explored in Star Wars yet. The big thing about this is, as well, I think that the animation style, which is a little more traditional, I would say, in conjunction with this, also works well, quite frankly, for this story.
I thought the visual design of the characters was really good, especially the Sith. Was a really, I forget what he looks like now offhand. I just remember when I watched it being struck by the visual design of the Sith character and the weapons he used.
He's got a kind of Doc Octopus chain.
Yeah, and he had kind of like a strange mask that was just kind of creepy and unnerving. I also thought, of all of these, this one may have done the best job of really developing a convincing sense of the relationship and personalities of the characters. I felt like these characters
very quickly.
I mean, by the end of this, I felt like I'd watched a full length movie with these two characters.
Yeah, and I mean, you've seen one of these characters for probably less than 5 minutes.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and stuff like that. Yeah, it's they really did a great job of the characterization, even though you get very little characterization about them. But everything is important, and again, I think that's so much of this one is. This is when you could watch 5 or 6 times, I think, and still see more meaning in it
mm-hmm.
because literally everything is important that you see. And That's what does this well. That was my take behind it, is that's what they did well in conjunction with this one. Again, I mean, you know, we're going to rank these things at the end, but this is definitely one of my favorites. You know, it's out there. I really enjoyed this one. I really thought it was an incredible use of the style. I also thought it was an incredible use of the Star Wars universe to tell a story.
Yeah.
Which really was very Star Wars universe story, but also a very universal, much larger context.
Yeah, you could have done this story in almost any setting and just use whatever the themes are of yeah. that universe. So it's kind of a standalone story. Maybe that's why it shines so well. I just sent Kirk a text a couple days ago where I saw somebody posit that one of the reasons that the sequel trilogy doesn't work is that, you know, the original Star Wars trilogy was George Lucas writing love letters to the movies he liked as a kid. World War II,
yeah.
Dogfighting films, westerns, Kurosawa films. And so he's just, you know, making those stories through the lens of the Star Wars universe and the sci-fi. And that to some extent, the Dave Filoni stuff that's on Disney Plus is the same kind of thing. He's telling Arthurian legends and more thematic narrative stories through the lens of this universe. The sequels didn't have that. It was just telling a Star Wars story through the lens of Star Wars. So there's really no sort of grounding for it other than we're just going to show you pictures of the things you've seen that we know you like. And I think you and I talked about that when we were doing our wrap up on episode 9, that for all the production quality and the acting and the quality control in the sequels, there was just no soul to it. There was no creative spark. Like, what were you trying to do other than just tell a Star Wars story?
And that's a good way to put it, is this thing, what we want to say about this particular, you know, episode of this is all soul.
Yeah.
And to that kind of point, you could tell this in any, you know, in any theme, but it also really works in Star Wars because it meshes so well with the concept of Star Wars, the light and dark, the, you know, what is light, what is dark, you know, what does it mean to be both, and the idea of transitioning between them, which is a sort of central theme, you know, I think in a lot of Star Wars, and also just the not really understanding how the world works, which is a key aspect of this. In both main characters' lives. And so, you know, from that point of view, I think it's one of those where this just clicked.
It really did, yeah. This one, and it's solidly in the middle. It's a good, it's sort of the emotional highs and lows. You know, you kind of come off that silly Wallace and Gromit style one, then you get into this one, which is back to that moody atmospheric, but the animation style is more traditional, and so it's less about a melding of visual style and narrative than just pure storytelling and character. So it was well positioned here. I really like this one. Okay, moving on, we are at The Spy Dancer, episode 6. I think this was the French
this
one.
This is the French theater,
I can't pronounce it. I'm even worse at French than I am at Asian languages. Julien Chang, and Studio La Cachette. I can't even do it. The cast is Camille Cotin, Lambert Wilson. God, I'm terrible with French. I'm going to stop reading these. This is going to embarrass myself. After 20 years after the formation of the Empire, a group of aliens with heterochromia and small horns run a high-class club, which is frequented by stormtroopers. It is revealed that the club's primary dancer, Loi, I forget how her name is pronounced, also French, leads a faction of the Rebel Alliance that consists of the rest of her staff, and she places trackers on the stormtrooper's armor during her dance performances. One night, she spots a familiar-looking officer, and in flashback, it is revealed that, 20 years prior, her infant child was taken from her by the supposed officer. Against her allies' wishes, she plans to kill the officer, only to realize that it is her child, now fully grown and integrated into the Empire. As her group battles through the soldiers and the officers, droid, Loi takes the officer to the roof and offers proof that he is indeed her child, leaving him confused. The club's maitre d', Hettis, helps Loi escape. Loi reveals that she left him a hollow device of him as an infant, which itself has a tracker in it. The officer views the hologram and uncovers his own severed horns. Mm-hmm. All right. This one just gave me sort of a general sense of like Vichy France, World War II.
Very France, very World War II.
Yes. a little Moulin Rouge, maybe even. I mean,
the other one I got, quite frankly, is Casablanca.
Yeah. It's, boy, it's, there's a lot going on here. A lot going on. And I kind of didn't really understand the story at first as it was going through. Like, what's going on here? And by the time I got to the end of it and figured out what was going on, I was like, okay, I got to go back and watch it again now because I kind of lost track of the narrative
themes.
This
is one of those that definitely gains from watching it twice.
Yeah.
And again, I've watched most of these twice. And quite frankly, I'd say that about most of these. I think most of these, especially up to this point, you gain quite a bit from watching them twice. You know, the Wallace and Gromit one, you know, I am rather not necessarily being, I think it's a little more on its surface. A couple of things I really liked about this around it. One, it clearly is a very different style to everything else. Like
the
French shows through. I mean, it really does.
It really does. Although I didn't realize it as I was watching it, that it was going to be a French production. I mean, when you watch it, it definitely has that French feel. I don't know a lot about French culture, really, but
yeah.
It just kind of feels...
It's French World War II, and yeah. Stereotype movie French World War
II. You've got the stormtroopers, you've got these dancers who are trying to kind of, pardon the expression, tiptoe around the occupation, basically. It just has all these sort of narrative elements that I've, just as, you go to like a Japanese culture, there's always this fear of like the atom bomb, right?
Yeah.
You have Godzilla, this crazy radioactive thing that comes from, that's unstoppable and comes from the ocean.
Yeah.
So the French, I wonder if they have sort of a similar lingering legacy of the World War II occupation, because I see these kind of themes appear here, and it just, I don't know,
yeah.
that part just, it leapt right off the screen to me. It was very palpable.
What I did like about this generally is what it was. I found the thing very interesting. I was I thought that it was a bit telegraphed as to the stuff with the sun, quite frankly, especially with the second watching. I saw it being telegraphed more. I didn't really catch it right off the beginning. The one thing I did really like about this was the concept of what is entertainment in the concept of the entertainment of the Empire. And this sort of playing off of in episode 3, the Emperor going to the orchestra that's just dancing lights. This being this, outrageously athletic, possible anti-gravitational sort of dancing.
Yeah, it's like a 10-story stage, and they're doing all these like anti-grav dances and stuff. It's really interesting.
And to me that was part of the fun with it. And this being, in some sense, a cabaret.
Yeah.
This being something which is substantial entertainment. This is bar entertainment for enlisted soldiers. And that's really who's there, with it. And there's a lot of jokes of stormtroopers like tripping each other, if I remember rightly, and like, stuff like that going on.
There's a lot of bro culture amongst stormtroopers.
Yeah, but it's what I thought was what I liked about this is it was a very everyday in the Empire type presentation with then an incredible import because of the relationship with her son and the stuff with that, and where does that go from there. It's also one of the few that I think gives you a there are people in the Empire who don't necessarily, evil, which is something we talked about previously, especially with like Mandalorians, and they played around in some of the episodes with it. It's one of the few that I think really does this is it to contrast this against our, water episode where Empire fully, holy, without any question, utterly evil in every sense of the word.
Yeah.
This being, this is somebody who basically has been tricked. Into this position, it's whatever it is. Empire, not necessarily all evil, even if concept of Empire all evil.
Yeah.
Which also, quite frankly, is a nice contrast to have both those in there.
Yeah, this one in that sense felt weirdly almost a little more grounded. It felt like a more, it is a more personal story. It's about, again, female protagonist.
Two of them, actually.
Yeah, two of them. It just, I don't know, something about it got a hold of me in the sense that, I don't know, maybe something about like a parent looking for a lost child and like he's with the Empire now and he's, her species has these horns and his have been cut off.
Yeah.
But then I was, the one thing that kind of made me kind of do a double take is that he takes his hat off, at the end and he's got severed horns. So he knows he's not human. And the Empire, of course, doesn't like non-humans. But then why is he trying to deny that he would be her child? Like, why would she make up this story and how would she know?
Yeah.
It was just that part was a little odd to me. Maybe it was just a narrative flourish to have a dramatic reveal at the end.
Yeah, I think there was a bit too much focus on the dramatic reveal at the end and leaving the future open piece of that. But overall, I liked this one. I thought it was interesting. And I really comment about it. To me, this is a grounded is a good word. I use realistic story, but it's not realistic in any sense.
Yeah, no, it's
a grounded story.
Gritty, maybe.
Yeah.
I don't know. This it felt very Star Wars-ish.
And it's very, as I said, it's enlisted Star Wars. This is not about an officer, even though he's an officer.
Yeah, sort of the lower decks version of Star Wars. Let's peek behind the curtain at what the lower level people are doing while the officers are having, meetings in conference rooms and plotting and scheming.
And again, quite frankly, the thing that jumped out to me was Casablanca, even though it's not really the same kind of thing, but at the same kind of base. Of the standard entertainment for World War II, and what people oftentimes associate cabaret entertainment, that kind of associated World War II entertainment, which is often associated with enlisted soldiers. Really kind of works.
Okay, episode 7, The Bandits of Golok, written by Ishan Shukla, also the writer. The studio is 88 Pictures. During the Galactic Civil War, Charuk and Rani are siblings who were forced to flee their home and are headed to the city of Golok for refuge. Rani is being targeted because she is Force-sensitive, which Charuk desperately tries to hide, and they're nearly caught when on a train ride to Golok, only to be saved when a rebel group called the Jengoris attack the stormtrooper-guarded train. They eventually make it to a small oasis setting run by an elderly woman named Rugal, but an Inquisitor arrives, knowing of Rani and the incident on the train. After tricking the siblings into exposing themselves, the Inquisitor attempts to kill them, but Rugal, revealed to be an Order 66 surviving Jedi, evacuates the area with her powers and fatally defeats the Inquisitor in an intense lightsaber duel. Afterwards, Rugal tells Rani that she must come with her through a tunnel to keep her hidden with other Force sensitives, but leave Charuk behind. The siblings have a tearful parting, with Charuk giving Rani a jalebi-shaped lollipop. I think that's like a South Asian candy. And Rani giving Charuk
her... Yeah, there's some stuff having to do with the sweets that we just don't understand not being...
Rani giving Charuk their father's flute to remember her by. So this one might be the only one where the main character is not female, although the character the story is about ultimately is female. Yeah. And the studio, I don't know where exactly this is. It looks India, maybe?
To me, sound India,
Pakistan,
India,
somewhere in South Asia.
Yeah, we've seen them.
And the visual design of the characters kind of invokes that part of the world, too, in general. Maybe even Egyptian. There's a lot of, like, desert-type stuff. So, this one, the...
I'm going to have you go first on this one, because I remember, Riley, we had slightly different opinions on this one.
I actually liked the story here. But I found the animation style really off-putting. And I couldn't even tell you why. Just something about it I found distracting as I'm watching the story. I kept kind of like shaking my head and looking back at it again. So I don't know what it is, but something about the animation just didn't work for me.
And that's it. I think where we had this discussion. I really liked the animation in this one. I really liked the style of animation in this one. I found parts of the story to be unnecessary. I didn't like the Raider raid on the train. I thought it was an excuse for a fight scene and could have just been left out, quite frankly.
Yeah.
The big things to me that I really liked about this, I liked the interplay between the siblings a lot. I particularly liked her being Force-sensitive and being essentially a playful child, not realizing the danger that she exposed herself to.
I think this
to.
Was the one where I thought that the voice actor they cast for the younger sibling felt too young for the visual design of the character.
You had that same kind of issue. And things like, what I really liked about this again, and to me the thing that I really liked about this was the older sibling understanding the very clear and present danger they are in, and the younger sibling simply not understanding it and being just a playful younger sibling and thinking this is funny. The example of where I jumped to is, in some sense, this reminded me of Frozen.
And
the concept relationship between the two sisters there, although it really focused on the fact there's no parents present here, which I think really enhanced it. This is one of the few that I think that really enhanced the fact that it's just these two alone against the universe, that you're in something which is effectively, you know, an occupied stronghold, with rebel activity.
It's kind of almost a loss of innocence story where he's trying to protect her and let her just be little and be a kid.
Yeah.
And then they get to this oasis and he finds out that he just can't. Like,
he can't,
at a young age, he's going to have to grow up real fast already.
And I think the thing with the exchange of gifts, you really have that. The focus on sweets, which, again, I know that there obviously is some cultural significance to the sweets.
I'm looking up what a jalebi is.
But it was one of those where my take from this one was, if they would have eliminated or reduced the rebel scene, it was a useful way to distract, to get them away from chasing her. But to me, it was an excuse for a fight scene in it. The real interaction here, to me, was her playing around with her Force powers, inadvertently attracting the Inquisition. Yeah. And again, I think to your statement, that leading to a loss of innocence. Which I liked. I really liked the animation style on this one. I actually thought the animation style was just really cool. What I really liked about it was very colorful. I tend to associate it with India because I tend to associate it with Bollywood, quite frankly. That very colorful.
Bright colors,
Playful form, which is why I was thinking it was potentially Indian. But it's one that I really enjoyed this one. So it was more than I thought it was. It's also one, quite frankly, I really enjoyed vastly more the second time I saw it. This was the last one I saw twice.
See, I've not seen this one twice. These last three I haven't, so.
Yeah, and again, I also liked the way they portrayed the sort of female Jedi, where it very much was a kind of hiding her, not even ability, but her strength. And doing so on purpose, essentially because of this calling. This is what she's doing. She's here to find people like her.
I think it is Indian. The main voice actor is Shiraz Sharma, who played the lead character in Life of Pi.
Okay.
So I think it is India based.
But again, it's I know we had the different things. We were very different on the animation in this one, which I think is kind of amazing.
We never happened. Yeah.
The one. And with the first one, where we both were very positive, but a lot of people were very negative, this was when we very much did have alternative reactions to the animation style.
Yeah. Okay, episode 8 is called The Pit, directed by Leandre Thomas and Justin Ridge, written by Leandre Thomas. The studio is D'Art Stagio and Lucasfilm. Just after the Empire is conquered, a large group of Imperial slaves are forced to dig a giant pit in the middle of the desert for kyber crystals, which the stormtroopers use to build a nearby city. After years of digging, they hit the bottom, only for the stormtroopers to completely abandon them in the deep pit. One of them, Crux, tells his sister Livy that he will escape the pit and ask for help from a nearby city. He successfully does so and manages to get the attention of the citizens of the clean, futuristic city, but stormtroopers stun him and drag him back to the pit, tossing him to his death. Livy inspires everyone in the pit to chant "Follow the Light," which echoes to the people of the city. They overpower the stormtroopers and rescue the people from the pit. As they leave, Livy is revealed to have kept a kyber crystal, which responds to her touch, revealing that she is Force-sensitive. So again, maybe this is another one where the main character is not female, although the main character dies and the protagonist turns out to be female. And then I don't remember this. It's sort of a broadly African American, black cast. The characters are character design is largely black. I can't figure out if it's based in the U.S. or if it's like an African based studio.
Yeah. This, you know, I'll start with my thing with this one. I found this one, I think the best word for me to use is disappointing. Quite frankly, this would have really benefited in my mind from being about 10 minutes longer.
Yeah, I don't agree with that.
It really could have done with some. The plot goes by too fast.
It does a little bit, yeah. And Leandre Thomas, the director, he's from Oakland, so I think this is U.S. based.
So that was my biggest complaint about it. I thought the concept of the plot was great.
Yeah,
I just thought it went past too fast, and you kind of missed important elements of it. Again, this being one I only saw once, but that kind of thing. You were too focused on it. It had a clear statement of what it was trying to say, I think, both, you know, from a moral point of view and with the storyline behind it, that unfortunately just went past too fast, that you kind of missed it.
Yeah, I don't have the running time here. I kind of felt the same way. I was engaged in the story. I was interested in the characters. I think there was like an older, like, grandfather type character
who was encouraging not doing this.
Yeah, that relationship was interesting. I think maybe what didn't work for me is that the main character gets out and then gets thrown back in, and then they're out and back in again. Because you and I talked about this when we first saw these, that I feel like I missed a scene somewhere because there's a turn of the plot towards the end when she goes back to, when they start singing and the city comes to help them.
Yeah.
And there's like a character that I thought was back at the city again. Like, who is that? How did they get there? So I don't know if, like, I had to pause this or something and I missed a scene or what, but something about the pacing of the plot, I felt like I missed a piece of the story.
The other one I had with it, and it just, I think it was because of what I was expecting, and it struck me as notice, it was they're chanting "Follow the Light," and when this thing starts, it starts with them turning on lights in the pit. And what I figured they were going to be doing is they were going to see the light from the pit.
Yeah.
From the city, and that was going to attract them. Instead, it's the sound from the pit that attracts them. And to me, that was, again, it was missed opportunity. That's why I sort of said it, is that to me it was disappointing. In some sense, I liked the presentation of it being oppression, and I think what he was trying to say in conjunction with it. But to me, again, it needed a little bit more layout. And maybe because of the fact that, you know, it just, you know, my background and stuff like that, I'm not necessarily the target audience of it, but I would have liked this one to have just literally been longer.
So that's what I wonder is if, I mean, obviously the characters are largely shown as being African-American. They're slaves in the story. So there's an obvious allegory to our nation's shameful history. So I wonder if there's some subtext here that we as Caucasians just don't know.
Or don't immediately resonate.
Like the Follow the Light thing. Follow the Light, does that have like a specific meaning, like in the post-Civil War era or something like that you and I just don't know? So this is one I think might benefit from a second watch and maybe even a little research into like the background of the story and sort of the symbolism and the phraseology.
And again, that was my thing with it, is I think it could have been done by just something making it a little bit longer. And it was a very compelling story. It was well told.
I liked the story. Like, I was really engaged until about 2/3 of the way through. Like, once Crux got out and went to the city, I was all in at that point. And then when they threw him back in, that was hard to watch. It was kind of that third act. I just kind of didn't really follow. Sort of the narrative themes kind of got muddled for me. So I don't know.
Yep.
Okay. Number nine, the last one, is called Awa's Song, directed by Nadia Darris and Daniel Clark, also directed by Nadia and Daniel. The studio is Triggerfish. Not long after the initial extinction of the Sith, the people of the mountain planet Korba are helping the Jedi purify the Kyber crystals, which have been bled by the Sith. A young native girl named Awa seems to have an unusual effect on the crystals when she sings. Her father, Abbot, is trying to help a Jedi named Kratu with finding a way to heal the crystals, but warns Awa that her singing is dangerous. While Abbot is in the mines, Awa discovers another cave entrance with crystals and begins to sing, only for Abbot to interrupt her, causing the caves to react violently. Kratu attempts to save them, but Awa realizes what she must do and sings again, which manages to finally purify the crystals. Kratu reveals that Awa must come with her to fulfill her destiny as she and Abbot have a tearful goodbye. So once again, female protagonist, the narrative of a young child being separated from her family, going off to join, I think it's the third or fourth one, join either the Jedi or the Sith, one of the two. I'll say the animation style here is similar to
it's a cloth style animation. No, the cloth. Even worse than clay, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. And a vaguely, I don't know, Chinese maybe setting, continental Asia.
It's sort of
mountainous. Yeah,
it's quite frankly, though it jumped to you as Avatar.
Yeah, a little bit of that. And the main character design is sort of panda-ish, bears, some kind of bear.
Rabbit,
slightly. So anyway, this one was probably my least favorite of all of these. The story was okay, but when you have the problem I had is that the visual design did not work with the story. When you have a character whose main attribute is singing, and you're going to do it in this ragdoll claymation style, then when she sings, they kept putting the camera at like a side angle, and she tilted her head up and just opened the lower jaw of the little puppet, and then we hear the singing sounds. And I laughed out loud the first time I saw it. It was so silly, and didn't, I don't know. That just did not work for me at all.
So my problem with it is, as I mentioned earlier, in conjunction with this, this story is way too big.
Yeah.
So we have
a little bit like the other claymation style one.
My problem with this one is she is at the end of this story undoubtedly the most powerful Jedi to ever exist. She has to be in order to do what she just did. That doesn't work. That doesn't work. I get the point of what they're trying to say. She purifies an entire planet of Kyber crystals with one song.
Mm-hmm.
That was my problem with this one. Is this story was just way too big in what they were trying to do.
Make it smaller. Make the dad be like a retired Jedi who can't do anything anymore because the Kyber crystal in his lightsaber has gone bad or whatever, and she fixes that one. Yeah. You know?
And so that was the thing I had from this. Is I liked the concept of what it was. I thought it was kind of an intriguing idea of the purifying Kyber crystals, the sort of light version. But it also was one that now we have kind of light versus dark becoming very clear, good versus evil again,
mm-hmm.
You know, which, you know, is the same sort of thing I had earlier with the other too big of a story is we just were seeing it really to me. This one. And then mine with the animation is, you know, this is an animation which is childlike, which has definitely sort of, you know, child qualities. It is like you say, you know, she opens her mouth and it's basically just an O, you know, of fabric, you know, sort of things like that. We have that combined with the most powerful Jedi who ever exists. It just doesn't work.
It was maybe a little too ambitious. I will say the sound design in this episode was really good. Yeah. Maybe that's why the animation seems so out of place, because the sound design was so good and the animation was so rudimentary.
Yeah, and well, combined with, again, you know, a story that is told very quickly and is enormous.
Yeah.
And is a little hard to track at some point in time, because we do have a Jedi sort of show up and it's like, wait a minute, what's the interaction between these people? You know, sort of things like that. So, yeah, I think that's the thing. We do have the ongoing contention of the fact of, A, I'm going with, you know, the child being removed from family to go to Jedi Order, which is an interesting concept, and I think something that was never truly explored very well in the Star Wars universe.
We had that with Anakin.
With Anakin, but it's, in him, it's not tragic until the end. These are tragic up front.
Clumsily done.
It's also clumsily done, which didn't help. You know, let's face it, when we talk about the fact of telling bad stories, I mean, George Lucas can be, you know, nailed with some of this too.
Yes.
So anyway, I think that's all of them.
All right, yeah, that's all nine. So let's try and go through, and this might be tough to do on the fly because you don't have the list.
Yeah, well, I can jump over you and look at the screen.
Okay,
here.
So Let's just go. What do you think was the best of these?
So I am heavily torn as to which of these the best is, and I'm going to go with Sith. I'm going to go with the first one.
The first one?
The reason I'm going to say the first one is because I just so loved the way the animation played into it.
Yeah, the painting one, right?
The painting one is, you know what it is? I loved the concept of the two-colored lightsaber and the exploration of a story of what does it mean to not be a Sith anymore. And to me, like that combined with the animation style, which I understand people would hate, but to me just enhanced the story. And that sort of, to me, was this game was the whole package. That's why I really loved this one.
Yeah, I probably second that. To me, I'm torn between that, Screecher's Reach, or the Journey to the Dark
Head. Yeah, I think we had the same top three without any
question. So those are going to be my top three. I might have trouble, depending on what side of the bed I get up on that day, I might determine what order I put these in. But those are my top three for sure. I'd probably go Sith, then Dark Head, then Screecher's Reach.
Yeah. But I would put it in the same order, actually. I would do Sith, you know, Dark Head, Screecher's Reach. Screecher's Reach, I think, could readily be, you know, a replacement there. The problem with it is, and I think this is the problem Screecher's Reach has, in another season, Screecher's Reach could readily be number one. Yeah. The other two were both so good.
That's the thing, yeah. I almost have to take the Wallet and Gromis one out of here. It's the only one that's like that. And it's really hard to compare it to the rest of these because it is silly and all the rest of these are serious.
Yes.
So to me, this is almost like the Jabba animation one from season one? It was the only one that was like that, where it was like a musical.
Yeah.
It just kind of didn't really fit in with the overall themes of the rest. And so I rated it low because I didn't like it that much, but I couldn't tell if I didn't like it because it felt out of place or because it really wasn't that good.
Yeah.
So I'd almost like take I Am Your Mother out of this ranking entirely because it's just kind of hard to compare it to these. Beyond that, the ones I liked the least, Owl Song is probably
Owl Song, I think we both agree is definitely our least favorite.
It's kind of hard to go from there. All the rest of these had things I liked.
I have to put that I really didn't like the pit. And again, to me, I found the pit just disappointing. I thought it was something that could have been a lot. It just, to me, just didn't work.
See, I liked the first bit of it. So that one, I don't know. That one had a lot of potential. I think for me, the second worst one is, oh boy, that's tough. I'm probably going to, this isn't fair, but I'm going to go with the Bandits of Golok. Although, I think it's just because of that, the one voice actor. It's not that her performance was bad, nothing wrong with it. I just could not get over that the character looked like, I'm going from memory here, but she looked like she was like, you know, 9 or 10 and acted like she, and sounded like she was 4 or 5.
Yeah.
And that's just the visual difference between that and the character's vocal design. Just, I could not get past that. And it kind of threw me for the whole thing.
Whereas I'm going to throw the Bandits at either my number 4 or 5.
Yeah. I figured you would.
You know, we're going to turn you around, which is basically between that and the Spy Dancer. It's which one you know, coming out of the top three. I liked both those, you know, sort of immensely. I'd probably put it above the Spy Dancer just because I thought that I loved the concept of the danger of being a Force-sensitive child.
Yeah.
And that was something which had not ever been explored in the Star Wars universe. And to me, just, it was a great story to tell, and they were great characters to tell it. In some sense, the telling it from the point of view of somebody from that culture really worked, too, in my mind.
You know, I did like that. And I did enjoy the way the setting was designed in the narrative. Like, you really got this sense of kind of being, like, out on the fringes of society. They're on the, you know, have you ever seen the movie Snowpiercer?
I don't think so. No.
It's not like a train that can never stop in this post-apocalyptic world, and it's, you know, there's always kind of social norms to govern it, and they're on this train kind of barreling through this like desolate wasteland and this desert, and it just reminded me of that setting a little bit. I don't know why, but I kind of just got that feel, and I like that sense of like the tension, the danger that was there. That was good. The rest of these are hard to do. I'd probably put In the Stars relatively low for me, for all the reasons we discussed, the animation style and just sort of the story just being so kind of bluntly told. And then Spy Dancer, I think, a solid middle of the pack.
Yeah, and that's, I think the thing with this is I think if we were to put these in quartiles, then all of the same ones would be the same quartiles for all of us.
Yeah.
Except for probably the Bandits.
Yeah.
And then it would just be, you know, which I think I'd end up putting that one higher than you in exchange for putting I Am Your Mother lower. To me, because I liked the humor, and again, I actually would have preferred it to have been more leaning into the humor, you know, piece of it. But It is. I think this is also one where, quite frankly, it would not surprise me to meet somebody whose list is entirely the reverse of mine.
So we do. Kirk and I have a friend who occasionally goes out for beers with us, Andrew, and I got his list. It was very different from ours. So kind of depending on, he's younger too. So kind of depends on your age and, you know, what Star Wars you grew up with. I think maybe influences how you see these and which ones kind of speak to you.
Yeah, and that's, and again, I can see it as, you know. Going as to what, you know, which ones you like more. I think there's also, because these were very multicultural from where they came from, yeah, there's probably a, you know, which just watch resonates with you more, behind these, which is also, I think, an interesting thing. I do think these were, in some sense, compared to the first season of these were more ambitious.
I think so. And I also, I wish I knew more about the various the cultures and the studios that made all these, because I suspect a lot of these have deep allegories that have a lot of meaning within those cultures that we just don't know, being, yeah, you know, white dudes from America. I don't know if there's something subtle, like the Spanish one, that would resonate differently with somebody who grew up in Spanish culture that we just wouldn't know.
Yeah, it's probably the Argentinian one, where you said, because I think one was from Argentina.
I think they said that. I think one was Spanish, but yeah, I thought that one was from South America. I forget where the studio was. But I want to say when these were announced, they said they were going to have an Argentinian anime studio, which I didn't know there was such a thing. But
yeah. And I think, yeah, the big thing to me is this seemed very, you know, very ambitious, you know, sort of. The one thing I have to say of this is make a season three. These are good.
they are good. I agree. And it's also a good chance to get some money and funding into these studios to give these artists a chance to shine, to show off their craft. And, you know, as you've probably picked up here, even the ones that I didn't really care for, they're still well done. All of these were very well done.
They're all well done. They're all they're all intriguing stories. It's what it is. The only real comments I have to the plots is, again, a bit too overbearing at times. It's what it was trying to be, more realistic. A bit too big in just sort of, you know, or short story format.
I thought overall this was a substantial improvement over season one, which was already pretty good.
Yeah.
You know, I think season one had a couple that you and I were both just like, these are clunkers. These are not great. There were none here that was just
season one also had a couple that were real stars too.
Yeah. But there were none here where I couldn't find something. All of these I found something redeeming or interesting or good about them. And it was really only that last one. Like I said, the sound design was good. The story wasn't bad. It doesn't fit the format. So yeah, a fantastic season. Definitely looking forward to a season three.
I hope they do make a season three. And the other thing I quite frankly love about this is Star Wars that has nothing to do with Star Wars.
Yeah.
You know, I mean,
do you notice that too? There was a lot less lightsaber stuff here. I felt the first season, every episode was about Jedi. There's a lot less of that here. It's more about either becoming a Jedi or more about relationships.
To use your sort of thing, it's grounded. There's a lot more human stories here. And the idea of normal people dealing with this sort of fantastical universe, which is a fantastical universe. I mean, we have a giant galaxy-spanning empire, but we also have mystic knights who can do impossible human things human things, but it's things the other aliens can't do either.
Well, you wonder if the difference is reflective of the difference in cultures, because the anime from the first season was mostly Japanese anime, I think. Yeah. You know, and so, you know, if you're making a Japanese anime film and you're looking at Jedi or basically space samurai, well, of course, that's going to be the most interesting and appealing part of it to do. That's what I would want to do, too. But coming from, you know, Argentina or India, where you don't have that archetype, maybe something else in the story and in the symbolism of Star Wars speaks to you and is what you want to talk about. And so many of these are family and relationship based.
Definitely my thing with this is I really looked forward to these coming out. I mean, I'd look forward to a season three. The one comment I would put about a season three, do we have to continue to use animation? Could we make some of these live action?
Yeah.
Could we have live action shorts, done by studios in conjunction with the Star Wars universe? Now, that may be difficult because it's just the nature of it's a very, you know, complicated universe to display. But that could be interesting. Or ones doing, essentially, for lack of a better saying, live action, traditional CGI animation, which we see in the live action movies.
Yeah.
I can see that being very intriguing. What can somebody do around something like that behind it? You know, I mean, there are obviously, you know, I'm thinking like Pixar, you know, that does, you know, shorts with very, you know, aggressive, very professional animation styles that are not traditional, so to speak. Yeah. I mean, they're more modern. It'd be interesting to see what it is. But yeah, my real take from this and my real take from season two is I hope there's a season three.
Absolutely. Okay, well, I think we beat that one to death. So we're not sure for the next episode. We've got kind of a long list of things that we have seen or that we're going to see. As we're recording this today, it is the fall of 2023. We are about two-thirds of the way through the new Ahsoka series. So we'll have that to talk about. Plus, we got lots of other stuff.
We both finished Bad Batch Season 2.
Yep.
We have, you know, some big blockbuster movies this summer we probably like to talk about.
Yeah, we got lots of stuff. So we're going to try and get these queued up and rolled out to you guys so you have hopefully more frequent content here when we don't have anything available on the main channel. So appreciate everybody listening. You know, this is the new stream. So if you haven't yet, please go give us a 5-star review and like, share, and subscribe. Do all of the social media things to help get the word out so we can attract a listener base. We appreciate it.
Thanks,
man. All right. See ya.
The views expressed by the participants of this program are their own and do not represent the views of, nor are they endorsed by, Lewis Rice LLC, its officers, directors, employees, agents, representatives, shareholders, and subsidiaries. None of the content should be considered legal advice. As always, consult a lawyer. This podcast was produced and recorded in St. Louis, Missouri.